Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. We've got a lot of ground to cover tonight. Two diverse subjects, but I think you'll find both of them to be compelling. In the second half of tonight's program, Peter Davenport, director of the National UFO Reporting Center, joins us to talk about a bold proposal that he's been championing for a couple of years now. He wants to create sort of a grid around the Earth, a detection system to catch objects that enter and exit our atmosphere, call them, for lack of a better term, UFOs. You got to figure our military already has such capabilities, but doesn't share the information with we civilian peons. So what about a private system? How much would that cost? Is it doable? And also, since Peter is on the front lines of all UFO reporting from around the world, he'll tell us about some fresh, right out of the oven, still piping hot UFO cases, including sightings from the last couple of hours. Pretty interesting ones, too. And a couple of these are mind benders, I would say. That's coming up in the second half of our program tonight. First, though, a conspiracy of another sort. And make no mistake, it is a conspiracy. It involves powerful people. Big lies, manipulation of the media, disinformation, and ulterior motives forged in behind-the-scenes alliances between wealthy corporations and individuals and so-called public servants who are supposed to be watching out for your interests and my interests. It's a topic I try to focus on about once a year or so. Some of you tell me you don't want to hear about it and you don't think it fits, but I hope you'll give it a couple of minutes at least, because this is your money being squandered. These are your public lands. You're getting the shaft. The wild horse herds of America are disappearing. It's because the Bureau of Land Management, this agency, which supposedly manages hundreds of millions of public acres, acres that belong to you and me, manages those lands instead of managing them for us as required by law. They manage them instead for one group and one group only. The ranching industry. Ranchers call the shots at BLM. They always have called the shots, and it's never been more obvious than in this wholesale decimation of wild horse herds here in the West. Millions of acres of land set aside by law for wild horses have been zeroed out. Horses are gone. They're replaced by for-profit cattle owned by private interests who pay next to nothing to the government to use these public resources. It's outrageous. They are flaunting it right under your nose and mine. Tonight, wildlife ecologist Craig Downer, author of a new book, The Wild Horse Conspiracy, joins me in just a couple of minutes to tell what he knows from his work with the BLM and beyond. And then in hour two, we're joined by former U.S. Senate aide and an assistant to philanthropist Madeline Pickens, straight shooter guy I've known for a lot of years, wild horse advocate Jerry Reynoldson, here to update us on an ambitious plan that could help solve the wild horse dilemma. But of course, BLM wants nothing to do with it. We'll tell you why. A couple of quick notes. Mitt Romney won big in the Puerto Rico Republican primary tonight. He bagged all 20 of the delegates up for grabs, according to reports I read. In the NAPS news section tonight on the Coast to Coast website, some items and oddities collected by webmaster Lex and me. A couple of items sort of tangentially related to our first topic, the wild horse conspiracy. One link on this site takes you to two recent news reports that I wrote for television about the Madeline Pickens plan to create an eco-sanctuary for Mustangs, and presumably why BLM will never let that happen. Also there, an article about in vitro meat. Sounds yummy, doesn't it? Meat grown in a lab. It's not in the supermarket yet, not by a long shot, but one day soon it will be. And some of you are going to buy it. And when you do, it could be a game changer in a whole lot of ways. Also there in the NAPS news section, Area 51. Of course, we know it well. We know it. We love it. It's inspired books and movies, TV shows, posters, T-shirts, rock bands, bars, a baseball team, an ET highway. So why not a brothel? The Area 51 brothel is about to open. It's legal here in Nevada. It's about to open up to the public. ABC News for Nightline did a piece about it. I've got a link to the story there. I think it's worth a chuckle or two. Oh, and there's a link we posted in Naps News that is a, it's kind of a lesson in humility. It'll show you a bit about perspective, how small we really are. Check it out when you get some time. Pretty cool. Time for our first break. When we come back, Craig Downer and the Wild Horse Conspiracy. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Craig Downer is a wildlife ecologist who has studied extensively wild horses of the West. He's grown up around them. He knows them as well as maybe anyone. He's here to talk with us about his new book, The Wild Horse Conspiracy. Craig, I think I first interviewed you, gosh, I guess about 7 or 8 years ago. And I'll tell our listeners, the interview took place, the first one anyway, up there in wild horse country of northern Nevada. And you really struck me as an honest guy, not a person who is prone to hyperbole. And I could tell that your interest in the wild horses is sincere, that you love these animals and you want to see them and our public lands managed for the benefit of everyone, not just ranchers. So I'm glad to have you on the program. I read the book last night, and it's powerful stuff. Thanks for being here.
Oh, I really appreciate your having me on your show, George.
Let's tell the folks a little bit about you growing up around these horses. This is not some recent infatuation. You just decided, look at the pretty horsies out there. I'm enamored of them. This is a lifelong interest of yours, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it certainly is. I grew up on a horse, Poco, and we did a lot of riding in the desert and the mountains here. I'm a descendant of the pioneers. My grandfather was a horse trainer from Denmark. And, well, goes clear back to the 1500s on my father's side. And so, I'm really identified here. But to me, the horse is just such a magnificent animal. It's a combination of their own unique intelligence and their amazing power and their beauty. And when they're free, they just are most alive, and they really, really are a presence that that is a blessing here on Earth.
Well, it's nothing quite like seeing a herd of them running across open range out in the wilderness. There's nothing like it.
No, they're inspiring, and so I decided to study biology, and then I ended up studying many of the different branches. As my specialty was ecology, where you have to know a bit about all the various disciplines. So I kind of cued in on the grazing animals, and I studied a lot about evolution and about, of course, ecology, how we all the species fit together and help each other. And I learned a great deal about the horse family and how it really did originate in evolutionary terms here in North America, and how it's a different type of herbivore with a different type of digestive system. It isn't a ruminant, and consequently it fills a very major vacant niche here that was only briefly, if at all, disoccupied. So I, over the years, I've pieced together a lot of evidence, things that the establishment's been ignoring, and intentionally so. And these I bring out in my book. And I would encourage anyone to collaborate, who wants to advocate with me, just to contact me at ccdowner@aol.com. And we can keep this movement going to really reinstate the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act of 1971.
Well, we'll get into that. It's the 40th anniversary of the act just passed in December. I mean, people forget that act passed Congress unanimously. Can you imagine? I mean, you couldn't pass an act now praising George Washington as being a great president with make it unanimous. Somebody would object to it, but it passed unanimously based on pressure from millions and millions of Americans who wanted the horse herds to be protected. It's the law of the land. And yet this agency, BLM, that's in charge of running the program, and they clearly don't have the horse's best interest in mind. And I'd like you to talk about, for a moment, You worked briefly for BLM. Talk about the attitudes that you saw within that agency during that brief period.
Yeah, when I got out of the Peace Corps, I served in Colombia. I worked a summer for the Battle Mountain District of the BLM, and I participated in what's called streamside inventories, where we assess the conditions of riparian habitats around mainly streams or lakes in the desert. And as you probably realize, the water is the lifeblood of the desert, and so much of the diversity of life depends on the little water that flows in Nevada and in the Great Basin. I was really shocked to see how the livestock, particularly the cattle, would camp on the riparian areas. And then what particularly bothered me was how officials would blame wild horses, which was a big lie. The horses would come in very neatly, tank up and leave along their neat little trails, whereas it would be the cattle that would camp on them. And I really resented that. And consequently, you know, I said, you know, these attitudes are wrong. And my direct supervisor had a sticker on the back of his car that was very showed his prejudice toward the wild horses. And I just, I said, well, you know, this agency has really got some wrong-headed people here over the wild horses.
What'd the bumper sticker say? What'd the bumper sticker say?
Yeah, well, what it said was protect wildlife habitat, kill a wild horse today, which is really outrageous. I mean, the guy should have been fired. But I would spend my weekends going out and being with the wild horses, and I just hated the lies. And so over the years, I've gathered a lot of evidence, and I knew Wild Horse Annie and worked with her, and later I worked for the Animal Protection Institute. I've been a litigant in many cases, some of which I've won. And I worked for various groups throughout the years. So what I'm envisioning is a restoration of the herds, a true implementation of the Act. The Act says they shall be given the principal resources within their legal herd areas. I want to see the cattle and the sheep reduced, and where possible, totally, displaced. And just as they've been doing with the wild horses and burros. I mean, this is a relatively minor area, and this would constitute true multiple use to see them realize their age-old equid niche here in North America. And they contribute so much. As I said before, they have a different digestive system. They're not a ruminant. They're what they call a post-gastric or a cecal digester. Consequently, their droppings are not as degraded, and they really build the soils. They contribute to the humus content, which makes them more absorptive of water and more nutrient-rich.
And you note in your book, too, their teeth are different, right? The teeth are different from cattle.
Yeah, they have upper and lower teeth. They have upper incisors, and they're able to prune vegetation, whereas the deer and the cattle, the bovids, sheep, they don't have the upper incisors. So they sort of shear grass and vegetation. They wrap their tongue around it, but consequently, a lot of it is just ripped up by the roots, whereas the horse can, you know, precisely prune. And their instinct is to spread their grazing pressure over vast areas. I did a whole study on the movement patterns of the large herbivores of the world, and I did a paper on that. They're generally a semi-nomadic animal that they don't, you know, naturally their instinct is to rest, rotate the range. And so, you know, I decided to be a spokesman for these magnificent animals who have done so much for mankind. And now I regard the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act as one of the true advances in our nation and for mankind in general, to recognize the place of these animals and to say, hey, let's let these animals go back to living as they have lived for 99.99% of their time on Earth. Let's let them have some freedom. So we claim to value freedom here. Well, let's let them realize some freedom and recognize that we're all related, and that it's not just freedom isn't just about
making money.
Exercising your lower instincts to go out and create violence and destruction. It's a really noble thing to.
Hey Craig, let's focus on this. Let's focus on this for a second. The argument, and I mentioned in the introduction, the disinformation and misinformation propagated by the BLM, the main argument being these are invasive species. They don't belong here. They have no place in the ecosystem. You've addressed that partially, but I want you to talk about the history of the horse here, because you document it very well in your book that all the horses on Earth came from North America, a lot of them from right in the Great Basin. I mean, they evolved here. They lived for millions of years. They spread to all the other continents from here, and they were gone for a very brief period in geologic history.
All the major branches of the horse family, Equidae, originated in North America according to the fossil record, and there's three extant branches, and those are the asses, the zebras, and the Caballine horses. Now, until recently, it was thought that the Yukon horse, Equus lambii, was a different species than the Equus caballus, the modern horse. But due to the painstaking work of Dr. Ann Forsten, the Finnish geneticist, proved that it's actually Equus lambii is the same as the Equus caballus. Genetically, that was proven. So that puts the species of modern horse back of almost 2 million years in North America. And that Equus lambii was all over the place in North America. So the genus Equus evolved here, and all the other dozens of genera evolved in North America. The burro evolved here. This is where its roots were. They more recently went over the Bering Strait when the ice age prevailed and the ocean levels were lower, and then they spread throughout the old world. But by far and away, I can't name another group that is more deeply rooted or that has a longer duration of time and development and evolution than the horse family.
The argument's relevant because the people who don't want the horses here say, oh, these are invasive species. They don't belong here. So a couple thousand horses are unwelcome on millions of acres of public land, but millions of cattle and sheep are welcome. I don't remember any stories about wild herds of prehistoric cattle roaming North America.
No, the bovids are recent, and I'm not saying they don't have their place. I mean, the buffalo is closely related to the cow, but they came over much more recently. I think it was 12. See, I have it in my book. It was only about, I think it was only about 2 to 3 million years ago, as I recall. It wasn't very long ago, and the horned deer and everything, cervidae, they came over anywhere from around 30 million to 12 million. But still, how does that compare with almost 60 million years that the horse family was here? And there were other families here too, of course. But the point is, there was a big extinction about started about 12,000 years ago at the close of the last ice age. And it's believed that it's tied in with a number of factors.
That music tells us we're going to a break right now. This is a song from Michael Martin Murphy. It's called Wildfire. And I guess it was inspired by an idea he got in a dream. He wrote the song. It was a number one hit for him back in 1975. Wildfire. We'll be right back. Our conversation with Craig Downer continues about the wild horse conspiracy here on Coast to Coast AM. Talking about wild horses and their place in North America, I mean, you think about it, and literally, they are the horses that we rode in on. I mean, they carried settlers and the soldiers and miners. They made it possible for us to explore the West. They were here for millions of years, disappeared briefly, then were reintroduced. They are a native species, contrary to what you've been told by the BLM. We're talking with the wildlife ecologist Craig Downer about his new book, The Wild Horse Conspiracy. And when we come back, we're getting into the impetus for the BLM's attitudes about wild horses, why the horses are considered a danger to public range, whereas millions and millions of cattle and sheep are not. Stay with us here for more of our conversation on Coast to Coast AM. Craig Downer, you worked for BLM for a brief time. You've interacted with them for years, including in various court battles over the years. Why the source of these attitudes? What is it that, how did this evolve this way? I mean, I know we hear that.
It's pretty basic. We're talking about people that are possessed by their possessions and their positions and their cultural upbringing. Most of the people today, they're calling the shots, are ranchers. And that shouldn't be the case. These should be people that serve all the public interests, not just one or a few, or the exploitive ones. I think there's much too slobbishness in America. And there has to be a more noble attitude, more spiritual attitude toward the rest of life. Too many people are just in it for their own egos, their worldly egos, and their material self-aggrandizement, and this is ruining life on Earth. And as I said before, one of the most noble acts that was ever passed was this Wild Free-Roaming Horses and Burros Act, because it said, "Hey, another species on Earth deserves credit, deserves respect, deserves freedom." And what I found is that it tied in so beautifully with the findings of science concerning the origins of life and how all the species of life interrelates in a harmonious way. A big lesson here for mankind. That's why I call the Wild Horse Act and its true implementation a giant step forward for mankind, just like the landing on the moon, you know, only even greater, because this has to do with restoring harmony and recognizing responsibility and doing what's right and not being so selfish. The solution to the problems that greed has created on this earth isn't simply more greed. That's madness. But that's what these deluded people who are power mad and who have lost all perspective on the issue are trying to tell us. And this is outrageous. It truly is. So everyone, I urge them to read my book, to read the message. I think that if enough people truly consider my message, it will make a big difference, and it will help turn things around here in America.
You know, I've known people in the BLM that I think are honorable people, but I think those folks who are concerned about fairness in the wild horse program don't last very long. They get moved into something else, or they get let go, they get transferred. Who are willing to stick up for the horses don't last long in BLM.
No, well, they certainly don't last long in the wild horse program. They might be transferred up to Alaska, where there are no wild horses. But it was better in the first decade of the act. There were some really good people, two of which I interviewed, in John Phillips and Lloyd Eisenhower. They were wildlife biologists in the wild horse program, and they were really trying to do right by these by the law, by the general public, and by these two species who have their roots here in North America.
But you'd agree, Craig, that it management, there is room for management, that sometimes that the horses do need to be managed, even rounded up on occasion. I guess where we draw the line is, you know, there were tens of millions of acres that were set aside for them by law, and there are no horses on millions of those acres now. Do you know the numbers?
Yeah, there were originally, by according to the true tenets of the law, there should have been around 88 million. And right off the bat, they lost a lot of acres through subterfuge, just people disobeying the law. But once they settled on around 53.5 million, there were in the 70s, they were trying to give them their fair due, and they had this soil vegetation inventory method. They were trying to honestly establish a good baseline of information so that the wild horse and burros could occupy their legal areas and receive a fair share of their of the resources and really be the the principal in these relatively minor percentage of public lands. What happened was greed got a hold of the program. They decided to assign the enemies of the wild horse to the positions of authority over them in both the BLM and the Forest Service, and they just methodically set out to discredit and displace wherever they could the wild horses and burros, who, as I said before, they build the soils, and I was going to say they also disperse intact seeds of much greater abundance and variety as compared with ruminant grazers. So they also, as I think you realize, are able to eat the drier, flammable, coarse vegetation and greatly reduce the risk of catastrophic fires in the process, converting that dry vegetation through their feces into rich soils, which actually retains more water. So there's just so much going for them. But, people love these animals because they are extraordinary animals as far as their beauty and their aliveness. And they just express so much. The Indian chief I talked to there at the Wild Horse Summit back in on Columbus Day 2008, Orville Looking Horse, he said, they pound the earth's drum, and when they run over the land, they release the inner energy up into the atmosphere and into the ethers. I just thought that was such a beautiful description to show this Native American's appreciation of these animals and their freedom.
And let's talk about the roundups, because it seems like the pace is increasing. I think a lot of environmental types and ecologists were hoping that the Obama administration would reverse things, would slow it down. In fact, it's an increase since Ken Salazar, a cattle rancher, became head of the Interior Department. And one roundup operation in particular comes to mind, Craig, because we were both at it for a period, and that's the Calico Roundup. And I think if people could see what is done with their tax dollars to the horses during one of these roundups, they'd freak out.
Oh, yeah. These roundups, the least of their consideration is what the wild horse goes through, which is really hell. They're jerked out of their natural habitat, their natural adaptations that have been established over, in many cases, over many generations, even over centuries, is disrupted. band or family unit integrity is disrupted, they're traumatized, just like a soldier that's put into a war zone, or some people that are victimized by war.
A lot of them die on the spot.
Salazar is prejudiced against the wild horses. He has made a statement in public before he was assigned to Secretary of Interior that he believed that the wild horses had no place on the public lands. So he is proceeding according to that prejudice to displace them from their rightful areas. So cynically, he says, oh, well, let's create sanctuaries for them. And then we'll have the people come and look at them, and then they can see the wild horses. Yeah, well, he forgets to add, he's taking away their wildness and their freedom, and he's taking away their ability to reproduce. And totally, he's making a mockery of the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act, which emphasized least interference or minimal feasible interference with the herds. It's just, to me, well, I really, as you know, I really value and care and identify with these animals. I think that at heart, every horse is a free horse, is a wild horse to me.
What I was trying to ask you about, Craig, was about what happened at Calico, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about the horror that you saw there. I mean, these horses are run for miles,
yeah,
and a lot of them never make it to being captured.
Yeah, I saw some terrible things there. When they're in the dead of winter, these monster helicopters descending out of the sky and terrorizing the individual bands, then running them into the capture corrals. There, you know, they really are in a panic state. They often kick and bite each other. I've seen horses go down with snapped legs and had to be shot in the head. They frost their lungs. Many of them subsequently die of pneumonia. You hear their plaintive cry, their whinnies to each other. When the families are separated, it is an anguishing experience.
I just remember the photos of the one that ended up dying in a corral, but it had literally run its feet off, its hooves.
Yeah,
run them to stubs.
The young ones that don't have the hard hooves, they're run until their poor hooves separate from the lower part of the foot, and they have severe laminitis, and it's extremely painful for them to run. Then many of the young males are castrated, extremely sore. It's just a very bleak situation. And yet I've had officials tell me, and it's in my book, I name some names, they'll say, you know, very crassly to me, this is where the wild horses belong, like to really rub it in to me. And I know, you know, just how they really feel here. And so that's one of the things, too, that inspired me to write this book. But my book isn't all about bitching. It's about emphasizing, taking the bigger view, and emphasizing all the positive things about free-roaming horses and burros, their justification for being here. There are many contributions, and I was going to get around to mentioning their great aesthetic appeal to humans. This is what people need today, is to go out and be with wild horses and burros. They're just inspiring presences, and I'm sure if there was a positive attitude toward them and promotion, they would be a major world-class ecotourist attraction. There's nothing I'd love more than to show people and share my knowledge about these animals.
You know, I have seen instances over the last 20 or so years, a few instances where they really did need to be rounded up, where there were extreme cases of drought and the horses were in really bad shape, no food out there, and they had to be rescued. BLM now uses emergency, and I use that in quotation, air quotation marks, emergency roundup. Let's go get these horses, rounds them up under the pretense that they're somehow starving or they're destroying the range. They have no evidence for that. And in fact, when they gather the horses, you can take pictures of them in the government corrals, and they're in perfectly good shape. It's just
it's a big,
bogus excuses.
Big lie. So regardless of how you feel toward the wild horse, if you honor the truth, you just say, hey, lying isn't right. And to get back to the earlier point about why are people this way, well, they're not objective because they're part of a culture that is targeted horses in the wild and cannot bring themselves to allow these magnificent animals their truer place in the world, which is in the free, balanced world of nature. And I admit I have an advantage, because I've studied nature and I've lived in the wilderness a lot, and I have focused on this. So, you know, I shouldn't be too harsh in my judgments of my fellow man, but I do feel this is it's a immature way. And in so many ways, it's a blind way of looking at these animals, just to regard them as either a domestic or otherwise misfit out here in the land of their ancestors. It shows, number one, the people aren't up to speed with the findings of science. And number two, they're not fair-minded. They're petty-minded. And I hate to see my fellow man in a benighted state. And that too, is the reason why I wrote The Wild Horse Conspiracy.
Let me ask you this, because we got just a couple of minutes left in this hour, and then Jerry Reynolds will be joining us. But I wanted to know about your view of the future. You know, you mentioned that you've been to court in some of the federal court cases that have been brought against BLM, Laura Lay and the Cloud Foundation and some very other courageous people have put a lot of time and energy and their money into trying to fight this thing, but most of the time BLM wins. And I just want to know, what's it going to take to change those attitudes? Because you would figure, as long as Salazar's in charge of the Department of Interior, it's not going to change. As long as you have pretty much everyone in the BLM in a leadership capacity is, in fact, a cattle rancher, not only allied with them, but is a cattle rancher, how do you change it?
Well, there's going to have to be a very strong reform act. Either it has to originate, I guess, in the Congress, and I outline that. I'd like to see a revised Rome bill that was earlier introduced in the last Congress, restore our American Mustangs. And I'd like to see it incorporate the principles of reserve design, so you have adequate areas that are complete habitats for long-term viable populations of 1,000 or more animals that isn't just a joke out there. And I've outlined how this can happen. You can incorporate natural barriers, natural predators, buffer zones, education of the local people, and bringing them on board through a positive approach. That's what's lacking. And if this takes creating a different agency, which it very well might, then so be it. Because if the BLM and Forest Service just continues to knife these wonderful animals and the general public in the back, then there should be an agency that has autonomy over the original legal areas, and that will mind all the points of law that can be used to establish truly viable, self-stabilizing herds through the principles of reserve design, which I've discussed, and it has to be worked out. But the will to do this is all important, the value. If people don't have it at heart, if their heart is in control and...
Hey, Craig, I'm going to have to cut you off there. That music tells us we're going to a break. Jerry Reynoldson is going to join us to talk about Madeline Pickens' eco-sanctuary plan. Why don't you stick around for a while, though, and come back into the conversation after we hear some of his comments. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM.